Again, my name is Karen Herseth-Wee. I live now in Northfield, Minnesota, with my husband who teaches at St. Olaf College, and I'm a secretary in the art department there, a job which I got as my children were not needing me so much at home. They were still in school, but I've worked in the art department for, I think, 15 years now. I grew up as an oldest child, one of three. I have a younger sister and a younger brother on a ranch in northeastern South Dakota. I loved the ranch. I was my father's cowhand from a very early age. I didn't like to be inside. I wanted only to be outside. My mother, who is sitting here, Lorna Herseth, can attest to that. My sister got a little more of the indoor work, and I'm not so sure she's real pleased with that, but that's how it happened. I loved the fact that I was strong and lithe and fast and able, and I could do the things that the sons of my father's friends could do, and I could do it better than they. And I would cut cattle for people who came to the ranch to buy bulls and be, you know, dressed in my outdoor clothes, and people would call me Sonny and not really know that I was more feminine underneath those clothes, and I took a lot of pride in that. That experience has provided me with a wealth of understanding in some other things that have come up in my life, which I will move into later. Then I went to St. Olaf College after those kind of, well, there was another big stage first. I went to country school through 8 grades, and in 9th grade had to go to town, which was 35 miles away, and we roomed in town and came home on weekends, and I hated it. I didn't really know how to behave, talking about social customs and conventional wisdom. I didn't seem to fit. I know I went to school with 2 different color socks on. One day I got snowballed by a group of boys when I went by, and I turned around and really snowballed them, and got told in homeroom later that this one fellow who sat behind me said, "Boy, was that a surprise. We didn't know that you were going to do that kind of thing." And all through high school, I kind of felt like I didn't fit. I was always aching to go home to the ranch on weekends. You know, most people look forward to weekends to go out with their friends and date, and I didn't. I really wanted to be at home. Then I went to St. Olaf College, and that's where I met David. We met in our first year there, although I turned him down every time he asked me out in that whole year. I had a boyfriend back home who was half Chinese, Catholic, and Republican. These were not qualities that were high in my family, but he was a very special person in my life, and at the time that I was meeting David, I was still pretty much committed to that relationship. But by the time I was a senior, I was engaged, and 2 days after graduation, David and I married, and we worked for a summer in Madison, Wisconsin, but then he had a graduate fellowship to go to Stanford Graduate School, and we moved to California. After our first year there, we had a baby. We stayed there 3 years, went to London, and lived for a year with this now 3-year-old child. Carried her in a jerry pack like I have seen on the backs of other people and sang the ABCs to her so that she knew them well at an early age. And then it was all this time David, who was studying English, was planning to go into the ministry. I knew I didn't want to be a preacher's wife, and some of you are and have lived it well and with grace. I don't think I would have. But somewhere along the line, as he came back to St. Paul and started at the seminary, he had also gotten a job teaching at St. Olaf, and he loved teaching. And I was teaching 8th grade in northern in Minneapolis. We lived in South Minneapolis. He commuted south, and I commuted north. By this time, our oldest child was in kindergarten, and I was pregnant with the second one, and sometime after that we moved to Northfield, and David began his teaching career, which he has loved and feels that it is a calling. For me, I've always lived somewhere between the ranch and academia, never at home in either place. And in those early years, I can remember saying to him one day, I would really like to go home because I want to be around people who have life written in their faces and they're not talking about it all the time. And that's still sometimes true. I mean, springtime comes and I feel the pull to go home to the ranch because I did a lot of things there that were connected to the earth. And I think One of the difficulties for all of us now in the age that we live in is that we have become pavement people. We do not have bare feet connected to the ground. On pavement, it's too hot. You can't live that way, or you step on glass. I think one of the reasons Holden is the special place it is because of the earth connectedness, the sun, the sky, studying the stars at night, being outdoors, except for when you're doing sessions, and living much more close to this nurturing element of the land. Another important area of my life is that somewhere back, we don't know when it began, but another woman and I began a writing group. And we have kept it going. We've met every week for, I think, almost 18 years, except for summers. We stay at a number of 10 in the group because if we happen to all show up at a meeting, we can get around to everyone's work that they happen to bring. If we're more than that, we can't manage that. Usually 5 or 6 come, and we've been the group changes all the time. People move on, do a different thing with their life, and show up again. One of the results of this writing group is just hot off the press. This is called Northfield Women Poets, the Chapbook Series, and we are each one of us going to have a little bit different colored booklet, which is a sample of our writing. That's what a chapbook is. And we'll be able to have them and, you know, sell them at readings for $2.50 or $3. And we are part of a larger collection that we got a Minnesota Arts Board grant for. But if someone comes and said, I'd just like to see your work, or, you know, I don't want the bigger book, we decided to do this. And we are individually hand-binding ours, so these little knots in the middle of these I tied just before we came here. I will begin by reading several of the land-connected poems in this anthology and then move to some other things. The first one will be The Home Place. This home place is about 2,000 acres in northeast South Dakota next to a lake. So it isn't your usual concept of South Dakota west of the river with acres and acres of arid land. It was a combination of cattle-raising land and grain and corn-raising. The shore of a sandy lake abuts the edge of my memory, close like the much-loved land. Some of us, mostly daughters, move away. But the feel of earth between our toes, sun hot above grain spun to gold, chaff and itch beneath our shirts, sweat and the brief cool reprieve of a reluctant rain washing through the cracks of western window frames on the old home place remain vivid. As if being young there had just happened, and our mother, seated in the shade of an elm shelling peas, lifts her head at our father's call from his pickup truck window to come check cattle at the Dacre place. The shore of a sandy lake weaves along the reed-slim edge of my memory like the haunting land. Each autumn, I hear calves bawling, and the calling geese, blues and snows fall from grace in that season. Years gather like fleet clouds on the horizon. I mowed a lot of alfalfa. This poem is called Final Cut. I love original earth like the pasture at home in Dakota that's never been plowed. Its curves reveal the circular shadows of Indian encampments and pasque flowers, faint feathery blue, the saffron stamens reaching like feelers. I remember my Mustang's hooves crushing them. Yet the pasques return spring after spring. They push up baked clay yet tied to the earth's apron. Each year the land's curves harbor pheasant nest secrets, the broken shells of my memory of mowing the blowing grasses. How in the last round I'd leap off the tractor to run through the narrow swath of still-standing brome. I'd chase out the small furred and feathered before finally thrusting a sickle through. Dad wondered what always took me so long on that last round, and I never told him. I wish I had, but I had not yet learned what we had in common, the prairie in our veins like blood. Maybe if we'd each sliced a wrist and held them tightly to each other, both of us would have been more grounded. Maybe everything else would have been different. And on the home place is a grand house that my grandfather had built in 1908. And just this last Easter, I got up early in the morning. Our families had gathered there and was sitting in the living room looking around. I've thought of trying to write about that house, and it has never happened. And I sat there, and these lines just came. So this one is quite hot off the pen. It's called The Heart of the Matter. This house, raised against all odds on the east side of Sand Lake in South Dakota, 1908, rebuilt itself in my heart. In the years after I was 20, I moved fast, moved 8 different places in fewer years, unaware that builders had been contracted and were already at work on the monumental task in my heart's space, oak banisters and all. 17 individually carved dowels to the landing, 27 more to the second floor, the bottom pillar with a loose lid where kids dropped a German oak nutcracker one holiday. We didn't tell. He lay there years. Later I searched for him with a flashlight, but he had gone, and I do not know his rescuer. No other truly grand houses line Sand Lake, the kind with carved lintels above each downstairs window, and sliding oak doors between the two largest rooms. But even such a house could not save Grandma Herseth from herself, her own dark interior, as Grandpa's large laugh resounded through its rooms after he'd bet on horses or drunk himself into stupors in distant towns. This house's attic in my heart allows such a view of distance that to this day, hills or too many trees closet me. Each spring, the pull on my body home foreshadows the day my heart falls down, the great-grandfather clock finally quiet in the heart's room. A refinished bookcase held cattle medicine in my young dad helping days. The dining room table still contains a carved edge, a buffet, 8 chairs that my mother bought for $74.88 when she was very young, before her marriage even. My luck to be brought to this house in 1940, a newborn. I know its intimacies, every depth of corner. I can move in its dark without sound, my hand finding light switches or exits before my head does. The women who come to this house to live with the men who own it do not know their way here as my sister and I do, and we banished ones resent those who later offer civilly to please feel at home. All the rest of the years that they live in this house, they will never carry its great weight in such a small place as a heart. And I rode horseback, loved it, even rode sometimes without a bridle, although that wasn't real safe and would have to get off as the horse was running. I have a poem that I've written somewhat recently called Horse, because it has the names of the horses that I had in my youth in it. But it's a bigger poem than that. My father died in 1969 on January 24th, and always at that time, I think a lot about him, our relationship, the past, about what it means to have a death date. And I think of Thomas Hardy and Tessa the D'Urbervilles. There's a paragraph in there where she says, as she's walking on the moors, that she wonders if she lived so attentively, if she could tell when the death date went by, as she can tell as we all celebrate our birthdays. And I just thought that was an interesting concept. This is called Horse. From 24 December to January 24, each day hangs opaquely toward the earth. A horse from the past steps from a foggy landscape as I drive to the cities, calling on the memory of horse. Bessie, Gray Lady, Dandaree, and the black one I never named. I remember the spirited sound, the hooves, the ice trip on this road to the airport at my father's dying, the dark, snaking, hearse-led line of cars through snow. The creature, horse, in my head, our source and connected skin, a deep memory, language resonating up from the withers. That black horse, carrier of more than spirit but nothing less, lived briefly on the land of my youth. My brother found it dead in a stubble field, kept from food by the others. 15 years later, I know it as a sign. Horse power, round of belly, great in shoulder, aging, I have come to look like horse. It has little to do with a fast way out. Already I have lived at the edge, neither in nor out of town, my piece of grass too small for horse or self. once many horses. Angus, too, ran in my father's fields. I thought my inheritance contained them, and then I married, traveled, birthed babies, learned I left more than horse behind. A pinto appears on the skyline. Its black-white arrangement of skin moves close to the freeway. I leave the car. It will not come. It will not put its nostrils into my palm. But the lost, unnamed horse someday may reappear, may prophesy. I search till then the winter prairies, the roadways, the far pastures. The title of this is called Before Language, which is the title of a poem in here. One of the things that has always intrigued me is communication, and it's the communication that happens when you don't know you're communicating, or when you're not trying, or the kind of thing. Some of these sessions have been fascinating to me in the weeks that we've been here because of the way we teach, through story, through myth, through the kind of cultural thing that Marcus has just been telling us about. And all those things are fascinating to me because we don't know how much we learn from those very subtle kinds of things. First, I'll read a kind of quick poem. I'm also interested in Native American concerns because of that, because of their wish to live in harmony with the earth, in circular motions, rather than being propelled from here to the moon and, you know, not figuring out how to bring your garbage back, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So one summer, we visited the Black Hills as tourists, which we really hadn't done living in South Dakota all these years. We came to Bear Butte, which is a mystical place for Native Americans, and David and I hiked it. I was also handed a shell once in a writing exercise, you know, one of these shells with a little trail, and somehow that shell and our Bear Butte experience came together. Swirls, small creases, a crevasse, a brown trail arcing around the gone snail, like the trail we crawled slowly in the heat last summer up and around Bear Butte in the Black Hills where prayer flags waved, tipped with grain, placed carefully in the crooked arms of old giant trees. And I remembered that it was wrong I should be this old and know about prayer flags in Nepal, in Japan, but not know of the Native American ones fluttering in sacred trees just 50 miles from my home. One of the great gifts in our family, we have only discovered in recent years, and David and I are parents of three children, one who's 29, a girl who's studying writing out in the East, lives in Washington, D.C., a boy who's 26, young man now, who is a professional juggler, lives in Southern California, and has juggled on the Johnny Carson show as well as at Holden. He learned it here when he was 12. A mime minister came to Holden and made him three beanbags, and he's been juggling ever since. You never know what will happen when you come to Holden. And our third child, Allison, who graduated from St. Olaf last year and is cooking your food for you right now. And the other thing about Allison is that she's a lesbian woman, and as she has come to know that about herself and what that means in her life, we have come to know a great deal that we should have known before. David and I have always thought we were just as concerned people, and have learned that we have a great deal of cultural and religious baggage to push off our back in order to love our daughter as we ought. With that, I will read you a poem that I wrote for Allison when she was 10 years old here. We had gotten in some kind of argument, a small mother-daughter snit of some sort, and I felt badly that she felt badly about it. So I wrote this poem, and then later that year read it at a reading, and she told me somewhat recently that she didn't like it, that I had read that. But in the meantime, it's become a wonderful connection between the two of us, and I'm going to read it. I'll read it once, and then I'll read several other poems, and then I'll come back to it, and then Allison has a contribution for this hour before she goes to cook. This is called Before Language. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong, my humor like a tune off-key not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise you, I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time when in the womb, strumming the same chord, we needed no words. You arrived running, all bone and sinew, and on every photo after, one sock wrinkles down. Later, word comes from Lesbos that you are here only for a visit. I'd thought you mine, that I could own you in my image. But you insist and show me that wonderful mind of your own, revealing the rib-locked secret, your becoming self, coming fast before my very heart. I don't remember when I first knew of the wild gene in our family. But dressed in fringed leather, I stalked it all of my youth from the back of a horse and avoided men till one unlike all others came and stopped my quest. I saw it first, though, in a farm-bred aunt who left the farm when young by bus to teach from coast to coast. She was always on the move, yet kept open invitation where she was for those who didn't fit. Then a nephew, drawn at 10 to the religion his mother left to marry a Lutheran, sought a monastery education like a moth finds flame, and you came to our lives, adept at math and music and secrets. I am surprised it took me so long to recognize the gate when at age 1 you careened down the hall of our first home, marked even then by the wild gene. All of these poems, you know, when you parent, they fit all of our children. This one I happen to address to a gay daughter, but all of us have said the first few lines, "I don't know how to say this, you are not what I expected." Your father and I came together at a particular moment in our knowing, and from deep inside you already were made in the image of the great God who loves you even more than I do, and that's saying something. Made in my image too, of course, and your father's, those young years when you looked like him, those tomboy ones when you walked like me. And now, woman, on course, among careless teachings and wrong-headed ones, to make your way, all the while reaching a hand back to me. I keep up, but I'm not as young as you, nor as urgent. But I'm coming, dear heart. Don't get out of sight. I am coming. I was at a reading at St. Olaf once, and Allison came to it kind of trickled in at the end, and sat down by my feet. I was wearing cowboy boots, and she had her hand on my boot during this reading. And it's those kinds of things that poems come from. This is one called The Reading. She comes late, sits at my feet before the 9 readers and our audience come to hear our instruments of voice, the cadences of words, truth hanging in the air. Her hand on my boot is warm. She leans this daughter heat into my thigh, a summer child sprung from my forehead like Athena from Zeus, her baseball cap already firmly on backwards. She sees things differently, fundamental things like music, love, possibility, and the uncharted routes of escape. My mother and I wonder aloud to each other. My father and I loud wonders to each other. Sister and I wander away from each other. Brother and I with little to wonder about. Such a cushion to spring from. More like a trampoline, all the tendons and bone creating a springboard. And any time any one of us can fly out of sight, we keep doing our own individual leapings, our pirouettes, springing off one or the other's most recent event, like last Easter, in a brown South Dakota park where the family had gathered and was walking and talking. Two took strong issue, thought at the wrong time and place, and several others of us knew it was just right for the announcement made by a grandchild to her grandmother about the grandchild's gayness. And she and that grandchild talked long on a bench holding hands, the bone and sinew keeping the tension just right between them, while others of us flew at each other about timing and such, not admitting the issue lay deeper than we could go on a mere holiday. The real wonder was the tendons, tissue, and bone created a net that held, even as some of us flew off and up, having a very long fall back. And again, I'll return to the before language poem. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women, easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong, my humor like a tune off key, not well received in your head or your heart. But I promise you, I will wait for the day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time when in the womb, strumming the same chord, we needed no words. Allison brought her guitar to this event, and not so many years ago, maybe two, she called David and me and asked us to come to a coffee house event up at St. Olaf, and we were the only non-students there, and she played and sang a song which was an answer to that poem. Knocked us over.
I've never fancied myself a poet, exactly. I do music a little more, and I learned how to play guitar a handful of years ago. I'm not supposed to be talking toward that. And this mom talks about some of her writings as sort of coming out of nowhere. You don't really plan or think ahead exactly how you're going to say something or even what you're going to say. And this song arrived sort of like that when I was fiddling around with guitar when I knew about three chords. But I've thought for years about this poem that Mom read when I was a kid and didn't want to hear it. And since coming out to my family, our relationships have shifted a great deal and our communication has been much different, and it's been a really wonderful thing. So this is sort of about that. I'm a little nervous.
Mama, won't you smile with me today?
So mama, I wrote this song for you. At a time when I'm just learning how to put my feelings into words. Mama, thank you for waiting for me. My language has an unexpected accent, but our voices still are harmony. Two women dancing, dancing on common ground. And mama, it's been a long, long time coming. You let me climb this rugged path alone. I'll never know how hard it was to watch me run away from you. But mama, won't you smile with me today, this different daughter is heading home. Is heading home.
But I find that a very spiritual song. It's not only a personal one, I think. I think it's our journey of faith, actually. And how outside of grace we often feel and make our choices. And the marvel of the revelation when something finally connects and comes to pass in the way that we hope it is. I think as a transition for that, before I get you to put pen and paper, I'll read a poem that just tells you a little bit more about the other angle of my family, and that's the one I married into. David's family has been a wonderful place for me, and I think about it in connection with their Northwoods cabin, which is now owned by 5 families, Grandma and Grandpa and the 4 siblings and their families. And I was just up there this spring and thought it peculiar that I really have not written about that, although David and I have been married more than 30 years now. And as I thought about it, this is what came out. Prairie Woman in the North Woods. For 31 years I've come to this North Woods lake home and never written of it, though writing has been my life. Here I always wake early, small children or grown, while the rest of my husband's family, him too, sleep late. At night around 10, when the games begin and the sun-sodden 10 bodies come to life, I'm weary and I ache for bed. But I come for the sound of it, the sight of it, the splash of waves on rock-strewn shores, heat on my skin, mosquito hum in the pine, the wind, finches at a feeder, a loon cry, and morning quiet at a writing desk. My mind's eye on the past, the present, my children's, imagining the future. David and I spent 6 days here after our wedding and then did not return for years. A legacy in 1981, the cabin became 1/5 a family gift, and we have brought the children each summer season, their impish forms, voices, games, and secrets, ghosting their fathers when he was young with his 2 brothers and Mary. After years near this water, I still don't swim. I sit at the fringe of things. I take exception to perceived selfishnesses, my own lack of tact. Sometimes I withdraw, but I always love arriving to the nurture of my parents-in-law, who from the beginning have loved me without question in this place. I am cared for. Their 50-year-old vision chose this spot. This western angle on sunsets, these pine, this hummingbird at the window, this section of beach where I hunt for shells and the fragments of past years. Gathered in a basket on my writing desk, I finger them, the smooth parts, their sharp edges. One of the things about writing is the detail. All of us live spectacular lives, but sometimes we don't look as carefully at the detail of those lives. And when you take a writing course, people will say, you know, you have to put the detail down. And I'll give you an example. This one came off my pen the other day. I don't think it's a great poem, but it's a fun one because it shows the detail. I was talking with Joe Jordan. Do you remember him in the village? Were any of you here? He was taking people on star walks and talking about the stars. And he told me as we were standing on the patio that we are all made of stars. That when stars burst in the stratosphere and their atoms split, well, I tried to put it in this poem, but anyway, they end up on Earth in our bodies, which are made of atoms, split atoms. And he said, if someone asks you if you're 20 billion years old, you can say yes, because you are made of stars. So this was my, I was thinking about that on one of my other session days, and I was nervous about coming here, and so I scribbled this. Joe Jordan from Nassau says, as we stood on a patio in the Cascades one bright morning in July of 92, that we are made of stars. That billions of years ago, the atoms burst when stars exploded and floated through time and galaxies and stratospheres into Earth's atmosphere, then entered a thunderstorm that hit Northfield the week before we left for Holden Village in September of 79, when I walked home in a downpour to pack away the last boxes for our renters before a six-month sabbatical here at Holden, drenching my hair to the skull. So the star you saw above Martin's Ridge that night in 79 as I trekked the hike of my life with Dan Erlander and Laura and Andy might have been me. My mind's eye, born of stars, lit like a lighthouse, a beacon right on the spot on Martin's Ridge where the mountain shoots down each side, leaving a 12-inch shelf where I humbly and no small bit frightened lowered myself to my knees and crawled across over to the next mountain. I also call it going from age 39 to 40, which is what I did that year. And I don't think I can hike like that anymore. Well, I brought tables for you, this Lutheran Book of Worship or the Bible, good sturdy foundations for your pieces of paper. Your pieces of paper and some pens, good rolling pens. I will need those back because I borrowed them from the office upstairs. But if you don't have your own paper and pencil at this session, please feel free. And I'm going to encourage you to write, and I'm going to give you the first line so that you'll know where to go with this. Thinking about the detail of your lives. And going with your first thoughts. Don't edit yourself. Don't come in as a censor and say, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Natalie Goldberg, whose books I love to recommend, gives a little example of this. She was visiting a friend in Santa Fe or somewhere, and they had been out talking and visiting, and she went home. She'd had three whiskeys and was walking home and started to write about it, and she said she was very tempted to say, no, they had been at a coffee shop having espresso. And she said, no, you stick with the three whiskeys. That's what was happening. And so it was this encouragement to tell the truth. To tell the truth about your lives, give it detail, embellish it. When you tell the truth, though, your facts don't have to be accurate. Does that make sense? You can make up the facts. And I have a piece that I wrote that I really love. I wrote it on the train coming here to Holden, looking out on a snowscape. And I wrote about my sister and I being young on the top porch of this house I described. And a teddy bear ear went over the edge. And Connie was only about three, I think, and she leaned over to look at it and fell to the bottom. She actually came out of it fine. She was in a sort of sand. There was a bunch of sand there, and when Mother got to her, she was playing in the sand, and all was well. But in my story, I tell it as though I threw the teddy bear ear over, and that she then looked after it and fell. It's a small detail, but I know as the family histories unweave, and since it's written down on paper, somebody's going to say that, you know, Karen wrote it, and she threw the teddy bear ear over. But I didn't really. So you stick with your detail, and the first line I'm going to give you, and then you continue, and I'm just going to say go, and then please don't stop your pen rolling until I say stop. It'll be probably about 6 or 7 minutes, because I've been too windy here today. It should all really be 8 or 10 minutes to see where it'll take you. But I'll say stop. But even if you get stuck and you say, oh, I just can't do what this woman is asking me to do today, this is really dumb, you write that down. You keep going, and see what happens. But your first line is going to be, I left behind to be here today. I left behind to be here today. Okay, stop. Now, this is the kind of thing to get you going, you know. If you want to call it a poem, you can take all kinds of liberties with writing. We always think that things have to be proper. It has to have the right punctuation, all this stuff. Don't worry about those kinds of things. And you can put it down the middle of a sheet with a wide margin, you know, and see how, if it goes onto the second page, you've got yourself a long poem. It's your life, it's your experience, and it's very worthy by itself. Is anyone here willing to read what they wrote? Share it with us. Marilyn, would you?
I left behind to be here today, a suitcase half packed, a bed unmade, goodbyes unsaid, and calves unhyped. But I have 3 weeks of memories which will be everlasting. Friends of all ages, mountain flowers, lakes, deers, marmots, glaciers, waterfalls, icy waters, towering trees, bridges that scare me, running waters, sonnets, jacuzzis, stars, more stars, conversations, laughters, tears, cooperation, lockers of food, cut fingers, giant, what have I got here? I can't even read my own writing.
That's all right. That means you're writing fast. That's good.
Okay. I can't read it. Kneading bread, a bay line, matins, vespers, dancing, ice cream cones, mermaids. But I leave to return, family, friends, responsibilities, decisions, loneliness, yes and no, richer because of my experiences. Love God, shelter me.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That would make a wonderful morning matins. Anyone else? Yes.
I left behind to be here today all the details and responsibilities of the tasks I choose to assume at home. Glimpses of them keep popping into my thoughts, as in the midst of a Bible study in purity and compassion, I suddenly remember I forgot to have someone phone Anne Hope. You see, on the Saturday when we return home, I lead one of our monthly trips for fun from our church to the Finnish Festival in LaSalle, Washington. Mostly elderly people go on these trips. Indeed, they're intended to help homebound folks spread their wings further than church and backyard. Anne is a Finnish lady who cares for her stroke homebound husband and really wants to go to LaSalle. I send a quick postcard so someone will call Anne to see if she needs a ride to church. Should such thoughts come into my Bible study? Perhaps it's compassion in action.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yes.
I left behind to be here today my son, suckling, gurgling, now over from my breast, milk for his mouth, now over from my eyes, tears, grief or fear of what may be, a well of yes to who he is, who he may be, the laughing one, tears of prayer that I might let his bottomless well, love is the sky, whomever he breasts to be, tears of thanks for the beautiful hair, tears of pleading that I might live. May I leave behind, fuck you, the voice that squeezes life from me, that squeezes life from them. Yes, I cry.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I don't think I've ever done a writing workshop where there haven't been tears, because what you write of is profound and deep and part of your life. It's affirming. I love the yes part. Anyone else? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I need so many words. I left behind to be here today busyness, responsibilities of daily life, which begin at 6:30 each weekday morning as I rise from bed, sunlight streaming in from the brick patio off our California bedroom, smiling bright, colorful bougainvillea greets my half-open eyes. The splash of drought-controlled shower water awakens me further before deciding what to wear this day.
Mm-hmm. Very nice detail. Yeah. Grounded. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yes.
I left behind to be here today, and all the new horizons rise up before me, immense and majestic and awe-full. New peaks as yet untrodden, new chasms still unplumbed. My own fragile moth being struggling to be born, shedding old fears and old cliches, rising up toward the heights new born on unsteady wings.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You want tea?
I left behind to be here today 6 puppies, round and rolling, white with pink noses, and with ears like tongues. Eyes not yet open, except for one slit. Tails that move in ecstasy while nursing. Their fur so soft and new, their smell so pure. I left to be here today 6 puppies, but one is under the dark, damp garden slide.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
I wish just a few words. I don't know how you people got the right to that. I left behind to be here today a son and a wife, a daughter and husband, and 2 very much loved 11-year-old cats. They opened one eye each and looked at me, and I could almost hear them think, why is she off again, always searching? Why can't she see that all she needs and loves is right here? And then they became more alert and checked their food and water bowls and fell back to sleep with the knowledge that they will always be taken care of.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, because we went over, I can't even set you at a second task, but I think I will leave you with a little of Natalie Goldberg's words. I really can't recommend this book enough. It's she wanted to write, to get other people to write, and she just thought it seemed like an immense book. And finally, when she got her idea, it's broken down in little chips of chapters that are hints of themselves. You can find on any paragraph an idea, something to take off on. And she is a very spirit-filled person. Since we've been talking about detail, I'll read you this little chapter very quickly on what she says about detail. And you'll see why it's important to me. I had a conversation in the village with someone about names versus labels. We were talking about labels. And why someone would want to label themselves in a particular way. And I said, well, there's a big difference between a label and a name. A name you claim. It may have been given to you, but you move into it. You claim it. A label is something someone else puts on you. And that's a very different thing. And she even addresses that in here. I was really surprised. She writes, she says, I am in Costa's chocolate shop in Owatonna, Minnesota. My friend is opposite me, and we've finished Greek salads and are writing in our notebooks for 1/2 hour among glasses of water, a half-sip Coke, and a cup of coffee with milk. The booths are orange, and near the front counter are lines of cream candies dipped in chocolate. Across the street is the Owatonna Bank, designed by Louis Sullivan, Frank Lloyd Wright's teacher. Inside the bank is a large cow mural and beautiful stained glass windows. Our lives are at once ordinary and mythical. We live and die, or age beautifully or wrinkle. We wake in the morning, we buy yellow cheese, and we hope we have enough money to pay for it. At the same instant, we have these magnificent hearts that pump through all sorrow and all winters that we are alive on the earth. We are important. Our lives are important, magnificent, really, and their details are worthy to be recorded. This is how writers think. This is how we must take pen in our hands and put it down. We are here. We are human beings. This is how we live. Let it be known as the earth passes before us. These details are important. Otherwise, if they are not, we can drop a bomb and it doesn't matter. Yad Vashem, a memorial for the Holocaust, is in Jerusalem. It has a library that catalogs the names of 6 million martyrs. Not only did the library have their names, it had where they lived, where they were born, anything that could be found out about them. These people existed and they mattered. Yad Vashem, as a matter of fact, actually means memorial to the name. It was not nameless masses that were slaughtered. They were human beings. Likewise, in Washington, D.C., there is the Vietnam Memorial. There are 50,000 names listed, middle names too, of the American soldiers killed in Vietnam. Real human beings with names were killed and their breaths moved out of this world. There was the name of Donald Miller, my second grade friend, who drew tanks, soldiers, and ships in the margins of all his math papers. Seeing names makes us remember. A name is what we carry all our life. We respond to its call in a classroom, to its pronunciation at graduation, or to our name whispered in the night. It is important to say the names of who we are, the names of the places we've lived, to write down these details of our lives. I live on Cole Street in Albuquerque next to a garage, and I carry paper bags of groceries down Lead Avenue. One person planted beets early that spring, and I watched those red green leaves grow. We have lived. Our moments are important. This is what it is to be a writer, to be the carrier of details that make up history, to care about those orange booths in the coffee shop in Owatonna. Recording the details of our lives is a stance against bombs with their mass ability to kill, against too much speed, too much efficiency. A writer must say yes to life, all of life, the water glasses, the Kemp's half and half, the ketchup on the counter. It is not a writer's task to say it's dumb to live in a small town or eat in a cafe when you can eat macrobiotic at home. Our task is to say a holy yes to the real things of our lives as they exist, the truth of who we are. Several pounds overweight, the gray, the cold outside, the Christmas tinsel in the showcase, the Jewish writer in that orange booth across from her blonde friend who has black children. We must become writers who accept things as they are, come to love those details, step forward with yes on our lips so that there are no more no's in the world, no's that invalidate life and stop these details from continuing. She has other kinds of things in there. She talks about the breath of a writer, and I was thinking about the first Bible study I went to when Susan Briel was talking about the breath of God that moved on the land before creation, before God created wind. That was just an interesting small idea, that there was a breath of God that moved restlessly over the land before wind was created. She talks about the fact that when you read writers, it's good to say things out loud, read things out loud, and what you are privileged is that you are getting the breath of the writer as they wrote down what they were saying. And it's a kind of passing on of the spirit. There are other kinds of things in there that are very moving.
And her
name is Natalie Goldberg. And this is her first book called Writing Down the Bones. She has a second one, and she kind of takes off in this one in some different ways, but it's just as rich. I recommend this one first. It feels like a first book. Wild Mind is the second one. Wild Mind. You know, they aren't, because usually if someone comes as a program person, they write ahead about what they need, but David and I were kind of quasi-program people this time. He on the board this week, and we learning last week how to be program people for next summer.
It's so fairly easy to find right down the bones.
Does she still live in Albuquerque?
I don't know.
I mean, I know the streets when you described them.
Yeah.
I'm from there.
She may. I'm not sure.
So it was true.
I think she is.
Exactly where she is.
Yeah, I think she is. I think she's Southwest.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the second name?
Wild Mind. Wild Mind. I send little bits and pieces out, and I have things published that way, and our writing group has an anthology where we're each represented. Actually, we have two of those, but really, this is the only thing I have. This small sample of writing.
She's just getting started.
No, it's interesting. People are different about that. Our writing group. Some people are quite hungry to be published and work zealously at that. For others of us, it's just important to write. You know, I think there's an ego side that would love to be published, but I remember the first year that I began to think I was hungry for publication, and I couldn't write at all. Who knows what happens and things like that, but, you know.
What did you tell us about that leaflet?
This one?
Yes.
This is the one of mine with a compilation of my writing. And I read you several from the first part of it and not through the half. I have a few with me, that's all. It's not in the bookstore, but you know, they're $3 and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them here. And I have a few more up in my room, so. Okay. Thank you very much for coming. It's a privilege to be able to do this.